Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. For nearly a decade, John Drew commissioned fake paintings, passed them off as real, and sold them to the likes of Christie's and Sotheby's. We'll talk with the investigative reporter who tells the story of what's been called the biggest art fraud of the 20th century, and the artist who turned out Monets and Picassos with ordinary house paint. This hour On Point, a painter, a con man, and an art fraud for the ages. You can join our conversation. Do you own fine art? Are you sure? Would you be able to tell an original from a fake? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Albany, New York, is Lainey Salisbury, author of the new book, Provenance, How a Con Man and a Forger Rewrote the History of Modern Art. Lainey, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
So what drew you to this most extraordinary story?
Mostly the fascination my husband and I had with con men. We often followed tales of cons in the newspaper, and we always thought that we were too skeptical to ever be vulnerable to a con. We were both reporters, and we were taught and trained to try and verify everything we came across, to question everything we stumbled across. And when we read the story about John Drew, we were fascinated by it, and we also had a general idea of how the art market operated because my husband, Allie, who wrote the book with me, grew up in a world of artists and collectors. And we were amazed by how many experts and scholars that Drew managed to dupe.
Mm. Well, so go further with that. A con man and a forger rewriting the history of modern art. Explain the scope of this. How many people did they dupe?
He duped scores. I mean, and we were just focusing on the police investigation. I mean, there are many others that never made it into the investigation that, which we knew of. But what John Drew did, which was different from every other art forgery that's been occurring in the art market, is he made the false provenances, and then he duped the archivists and the system that protects the provenance of artworks and managed to slip those fake documents into the archives.
So talk about the provenance, those pieces of that documentation, the history of the painting and its ownership. How was he able to doctor that and really work his way into some of the most prestigious art archives in the world?
Like every good con man, Drew did a lot of research into how the art market operated. Every con needs to study the field. So he figured out how artwork is authenticated, and he studied the collectors of some of these artists, and using those figures, he made up false documentation that showed that were receipts, they were exhibition catalogs, titles, bill of sale, and he doctored all those and then slipped them into the archives. And what helped him as well was that he stole some archives as well, which had some of the gallery headings on it. So he was using original papers for some of his forgeries.
So he forged the paperwork. He needed an artist. He needed some art in the first place. Tell me how he came upon John Myatt.
John Myatt was, at the time, a struggling, desperate father. He was a single father. He had two children. He wasn't earning enough money, and he was a very talented painter, and he decided that he could try to make some extra money by advertising in a magazine for anybody who was interested in owning a forgery. But these were genuine forgeries. He wasn't trying to sell them as fakes, unwittingly. Mm-hmm. It was all above board. And John Drew read the advertisement and called him up and said, I would like a Matisse, and wasn't very specific, and Myatt painted him one, and Drew loved it and paid him for it and then asked for another.
And initially, he didn't know that anything was amiss. He didn't know these paintings were being sold or, taken off as fakes, as forgeries.
No, and what John Drew did with John Myatt is also very typical of how a con man operates. He befriended Drew. There's different ways to bring a mark into your thrall and to make him your puppet, basically. And John Drew, I guess, recognized that John Myatt was talented and that he could be used for his own gain, and became John Myatt's friend. and became his sort of mentor of sorts. John Mide at the time was leading quite an isolated existence. He had friends, but he didn't have time to see them. And John Myatt was sort of like a shot of adrenaline for Myatt. It got him out of his own sort of depressing world and was constantly validating him and supporting him. And he was kind of, he almost in a way became John Myatt's dealer in a sense.
He also, John Myatt had two children that he was trying to feed and raise on his own. He was in a difficult situation. I mean, these forgeries, though, thank gosh, they were not even oil paintings, were they?
No.
That's the unbelievable part of this. This was house paint, right?
Yes, oil paints gave John Myatt a headache, so he didn't like to use that medium. And the beauty of house paint was that he could walk down to the local hardware store and get any color he wanted. You know, tins of Aegean green or Tuscan gold. You know, he could get beautiful colors in these big vats. It was cheap and it was quick. The problem with oils is that it takes many, many years for it to properly dry, and with house paint, it's only a couple. A week or two. So he could churn these out very quickly hit the market with many fakes in a quick amount of time and get make a lot of money.
Well, how much money? How much were they selling for?
Well, it varied. There were a couple that sold for about £200,000. Some sold for £5,000. There was a range. I think they were all cheap enough that they probably didn't get the scrutiny that they deserved.
So forged artwork, forged paperwork, selling these paintings for hundreds of thousands of dollars each to prestigious art dealers, museums around the world. How did this complex story come unglued?
I think there are just, for one, there are just so many fake artworks spreading around the market that people started to get suspicious because they started to see too many of them, and the provenance started to begin to have a consistency. John Drew used fake labels on the back of work, so those started to look familiar. So some dealers were starting to raise their eyebrows. A couple called the police. But that didn't really get anything moving until John Drew's ex-partner, Batsheva Goodsmit, found three bagloads of false documents, or what she thought were forged documents, in the attic of her house after their relationship had basically imploded. And brought those to the police, and they went through it and realized that they had either a stolen art case on their hands or a forgery case on their hands.
What I found so interesting in the book was after the scandal broke, commercial galleries, private dealers, many cooperated with police, but the public institutions like the prestigious Tate, the Victoria and the Albert Museum, refused to cooperate. Why was that?
Well, in the beginning, I think they were quite embarrassed. I mean, they did end up cooperating with the police. And in fact, if I remember correctly, they called the police after they were warned several times by an archivist who was the head of the archives at the Tate, who was very concerned about John Drew, who was a frequent customer to the archives. He kept coming in, acted very differently from the other researchers. He always knew what he wanted. Most researchers are on a fishing expedition. They're not sure what they're looking for until they find it. Mm. But John Drew was always very specific. I'm not quite sure why they were not as helpful in the beginning as they were. I think they were embarrassed, and I think they worried that their reputation would be damaged. But I think the more important you are, the more important it is for you to step out and say this has happened, because it's a wake-up call for everybody else.
So what happened to John Drew? Did he go to prison?
Yes. Mm-hmm. After a very sort of drawn-out court case in which he represented himself, but he ended up going to prison. And he did not plead. He claimed he was not guilty. He still claims he's not guilty. And he said this was a vast conspiracy by the British government to sell fake art through him. He didn't know it was fake, to be able to supply weapons to rogue nations.
So he's a bit of a madman of sorts. What happened to Myatt, the artist who at first was unwittingly supplying his art, his work to John Drew?
He too went to prison, but he ended up helping the police in the investigation. John Drew, I think, became quite an intimidating character towards the end, and John Myatt was quite scared of him. And he helped the police, but he pled guilty to forgery, and he was convicted, and he spent about 4 months in prison. But what John Drew failed to recognize is that the public tends to love forgers in a way. We sort of see them as lovable rogues because they took down a sophisticated world that many of us feel that we're excluded from. We don't fully understand how the art market works. It's not very transparent. And he sort of became a hero. And when he got out of prison, people started asking him for fakes, legitimate fakes, and he began to paint a couple for some of the investigators involved. Then the prosecutors wanted one.
Even the policeman who arrested him.
Yes. He to this day still believes that John Myatt is a very talented painter and had him do a portrait of his family.
You mentioned the sophisticated art world that exists. How did this extraordinary act affect the art world?
I think forgeries are actually good for the art world. I think it makes people wake up and look at the art again. There's two ways to look at art. You can look at art for its beauty, for its intrinsic merit. We should all be buying art because we think it's beautiful, not because of who painted it. And there's another part of the profession that buys art because it's a collectible for its financial value. It's an investment for the future. It's worth a lot of money, and it makes them feel sort of a sophistication that they've arrived in that sense. And it's when people focus too much on the financial value of art that they tend to get into trouble because they stop looking at the art itself. One of the things about provenance, the documentation is that if it's owned by a celebrity or a great expert, it boosts the value.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about art, fraud, and the art of the con. My guest this hour is Lainey Salisbury, author of the fascinating new book, Provenance, How a Con Man and a Forger Rewrote the History of Modern Art. You can get an excerpt and link to images of those forged paintings that we've been speaking of at our website, onpointradio.org. I'd like now to bring another voice into the conversation. Joining me from Stoke, England, is John Myatt. He painted over 200 forgeries that sold as the work of master artists. He served 4 months in prison for his role in the fraud and now makes a living selling his legitimate fakes. He's profiled in the book Provenance. John, welcome to On Point. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Jane. Hello.
Hello. So take us back a decade or so to the circumstances that led you to John Drew, this con man who sold your art. How did you two meet?
Well, I mean, Lane has just done such a great job with this book. It's astonishing. Reading about yourself like this it's never happened to me before, and I must say, well done to her. She's done such a great job. I put an advert in a magazine, and for 2 or 3 years, I think any number of customers replied to the advert. It said genuine fakes from, I think, £150 to £250, and different people replied. And over time, one person kept on coming back over and over and over again. And this man was the Mr. Drew you've been talking about. That's how it started. That's how I met him.
And your initial impressions of him?
Oh, fabulously sophisticated. I mean, what a guy. Looking back on it, he was extremely elegant. He had this, aura of intellectual, sort of university, academic sort of parlance that he sort of spoke. Very, very sophisticated. Drove a handmade car. Some chap in London makes about 4 cars a year. He had one of them in Bristol. Mm-hmm. Just for me at that particular time when I was struggling around to changing nappies and generally, you know, if there's any single parents listening, I mean, they'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. It's 4 walls, and the world outside kind of disappears for a wee while. And this guy was such a breath of fresh air to me that I really enjoyed meeting him. I hadn't the slightest idea that there was anything dodgy about him at all.
You didn't. You had no inclination, no inkling that there was something not quite right.
Nope, not at all. I found him enormously impressive.
So how long did you work with him, for him, before you started indeed thinking something was wrong?
2 years. Maybe best part of 2 years, say 20 months or something. And by that time, he'd had getting on for 12 or 13 paintings off me. And the very last painting he had, as it were, on a genuine basis, was a painting, a very small cubist painting. He actually ran out of ideas. He didn't know what to commission next. And he said to me, he said, John, what would you like to paint? And I said, well, I've always liked cubist paintings. What about I try one of those for you? Yep, okay, he said. And when I delivered that cubist painting, I actually thought to myself, well, this is the last time I'm going to see him. What a shame, he's been such a good customer. And anyway, about only a week or so later, the phone rang and he said, you know that cubist painting you did for me? I said, yep. He said, well, I've just taken it into Christie's and they've valued it at £25,000, which is probably getting on for $40,000, I suppose. Do you want the normal £250 that I pay you, or would you like to have half of that money, £12,500, if you come down to London, I'll give you the money? Hmm. Well, he hadn't actually sold it through Christie's, but what he'd got was a Christie's valuation on paper. So he would approach another customer, say, or another gallery and say, well, look, here's the painting. I've got a Christie's valuation for it. That's kind of as good as it gets. You know, okay, they value it at 25,000. You can have it for 24. Mm. So that was how it happened. Now, at that point, if I'd actually stopped and said, no, I'll have the £200 and have, you know, don't ever darken my door again, that kind of, none of this, I wouldn't be talking to you now.
So that moment when you made the conscious decision to be part of this fraud, of John Drew's fraud, did anybody else know what you were doing? Anybody close to you, your family, your friends?
No, Jane, absolutely not. I had a father-in-law who lived in Spain, and I told him, and he thought it was hilarious. And then within about two months, he had a stroke and died. But after that, I thought it was best to just keep my own counsel and not mention to anybody.
Did you ever want out of this? Did you ever think, this is getting to be too much?
Well, I think, as Laney says in the book, you can see as the thing progressed, as the scam or crime or whatever you call it, progressed, Mr. Drew sort of deteriorated, really. He almost fell apart. And largely, I think, because of domestic problems he had. And having gone through those kind of problems myself, I was enormously sympathetic for him. You know, when a relationship goes south, it's sad all round. And I did what I could to support him. But in fact, I don't know, he handled it very badly. He basically cracked up. Watching him do that and then becoming increasingly kind of paranoid and violent, as I thought, was one reason that I wanted to get out. And the second was, quite frankly, you know, I was brought up not to do this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I wasn't brought up to be a crook. And I really just sort of thought to myself, you know, this isn't me. I don't do this kind of thing.
So you had 200 or more forged paintings out there,
yes,
somewhere. Scotland Yard caught on. They came. They arrested you. Did you ever fully expose all the forgeries that you painted? I mean, are there still people out there who don't know that their paintings are fake, are forged?
Yeah, there's 120 paintings still out there.
There are?
Yeah. That's what the police say. They recovered 80. And as Laney said, so sort of, it's a wonderful piece that she's just done, as Laney said, that they had so much evidence that you couldn't have filled the courtroom with it. They actually said, OK, well, we've got 80, and they reduced it to 40. Then they reduced that to 20, and then they reduced that to 12. And I think there were 12 exhibits in the court when I was there. But of the 80 they recovered, they have records, well, they suspected they had. There was a total of 200, and 120 paintings, drawings and watercolours are, as it were, unaccounted for.
Laney, was there ever any effort to track down those people who received those forgeries to be told indeed the truth?
The other 120?
Yes. Yes, Laney.
Well, I think the investigation is actually still ongoing. The police won't release all the evidence because they're still investigating certain aspects of the case. So, and they won't say what they're doing, but they could be doing that. But also it was a question of they had to keep it simple. I mean, this investigation couldn't go on forever. John Drew would get rid of the evidence eventually. So they had to narrow it down, and they had to keep it simple, or else it would have spiraled out of control.
John Myath, what does this whole experience make you think about the world of art today? I mean, you were right in the middle of it, painting forgeries, first unwittingly, but then, yes, you were, buying and selling these paintings as a commodity. I mean, what do you make of the art world today?
I think the system of authentication is really, isn't it silly that you can paint a work in household emulsion paint and get it kind of authenticated? As Laney says, people are looking at the history of the painting rather than using their eyes to look at the actual work itself. And these are tend to be people who invest, and I think, as it were, priorities need to be slightly shifted. What do I think? I don't know what I think about it, really. I just think that it is a business that depends on honesty. That's as someone who was involved in the crime personally, I think it's very easy for unscrupulous people like John, or who use me, and I take my own share of the blame for it. It's very easy for unscrupulous people to use a system which does depend on everybody saying or being what they say they are. And when someone pretends to be something that they're not, in John Drew's case, he pretended to be a great art collector or representing a whole lot of other collectors and so forth. Why should people sort of get suspicious? They did in the end, but it is a business that depends on trust. The second thing, sorry to keep on talking, is there's an awful lot of snobbery in it. And Laney touched on that, didn't she, about, you know, the Tate Gallery and the, there's an awful, strangely enough, because of the money, I think, there's an awful lot of, oh, you know, well, I've got a Van Gogh or that kind of, you know, snobbery associated with art and art appreciation. Those two things.
Hey, Laney, was that the takeaway for you as the journalist who looked into the story and uncovered all of this, that how easy it is to get sucked into a con?
Yes. I mean, I went into this thinking that dealers would be manic about protecting authenticity of works, but they not all of them are. And part of the reason is it's not so much that they're dishonest and they're bad people. I mean, there's a lot of good dealers out there, but they're coming up against collectors who have millions of dollars. Big lawyers, you know, they can't afford always to cry fake. So if they see a fake, many of them just turn a blind eye and they walk away. Or if it's a really good one, they might just pass it on because they don't want to become liable. You know, they don't want to be, they could be sued for libel for defamation of product, even for defamation of the person who bought it by claiming that they bought a fake. So they don't always speak out.
Gosh, so interesting. Let's go to the calls and get some listeners' perspectives in here. Vanya is calling from Northfield, Connecticut. Welcome to the program. Hello.
Thank you. Hello.
Hi.
I have a slightly different question, which is the question of what really constitutes artwork? Is it the fact that this is a canvas that the painter touched, or is it the feeling that is evoked by the artwork? And the story that I would like to share with you, there was my family, my grandmother was a collector of Impressionist art in the turn of the century, of the last century, and had quite a collection. And my mother grew up with a very high-quality Impressionist painting that was then in our household. And they got a little worried about it, and so they had a copy of it made, including the signature. It was a very good copy. Mm-hmm. And when they would go away, they'd put it in the safety in the bank. And this was up on the wall. And my mother's brother, who was the head of a major art museum in the United States, came by to visit. This is a person who'd grown up with the painting. And he came by to look at it and said, "My God, it takes me back. I love looking at that painting so much." And so the question that I have is it the actual painting or is it what it evokes? Is it the fact that it's a copy and yet it can still evoke that? Or is it, you know, that it's this piece of canvas actually touched by the master himself?
Vanya, thank you. John Myatt, what do you think?
Wow. You know, we're getting into very ethical. You can think of like a Mozart piano concerto, can't you? It's basically the same kind of thing, but different people play it in different ways. Yes, I mean, the answer is, I think it is the person who touched it in the first place. The Monet, the Monet is the Monet because Monet painted it. Now, if it's just a copy, of the Monet, a brush-by-brush mark, recreation of the painting, I don't think that's that impressive. In a way, it's just a series of technical parlor tricks to do that. What I was trying to do, and I think what a good faker or forger tries to do, is to create a new Monet, a brand new one, something that Monet might have done that day but didn't quite get the time to. Mm. That's the interesting aspect of what I consider my job now, is that you kind of get under the skin of Claude Monet and think, right, we'll make a new one, or Braque or Picasso or whatever. But the gentleman's question, just probably better answered by Laney than me because she's more intelligent and articulate. But I mean,
let me ask you this, Laney. I mean, you uncovered discovered this most far-reaching and elaborate deception in the art world. How common is this kind of activity, forgeries and such, maybe on not on this scale, but on a smaller scale? Is it widespread?
Oh, yeah, forgeries are going on all the time, and the really, really good ones never get caught. I mean, look at the, there's that Greek statue of the Koros bought by the Getty Museum. They had to have an international conference on that sculpture to determine whether it was authentic or not. They paid $7 million for it, and they still don't know. Some archaeologists and art historians say it's fake. The scientists who did forensics on it say it's real. So if you go to the museum and you see the statue, there the plaque says Greek sculpture 530 BC or modern forgery. And there's a lot of forgeries out there. Because there are a lot of good artists. They're very talented. And the business is such that it is so unregulated that it's very easy to slip these into the market. There was a dealer the other day who was just in prison because he was buying authentic Chagalls and then having the copies made and selling the copies back onto the market. And he was a dealer.
Here's another call from Boston. Emma is on the line. Hello, Emma.
Hi there.
Hi. Go ahead.
Well, I just thought what John said about the Monets was very interesting because I guess in response to the other caller, I was going to say that my opinion of a forged painting is that if it's a copy, even if it looks exactly like the original painting, I just sort of have this negative reaction to it on principle, because what's so exciting to me about a painting is not just its beauty, but the fact that, you know, you're looking at the artist's original thought process and their creative process really laid right out on the canvas. So I thought what John said about sort of getting back inside Monet's head and creating a new Monet was a really really interesting take on, you know, the sort of honest forgeries that he does now.
Emma, thank you. What about that? That's really interesting that the intention behind the painting is just as important as its beauty. John Myatt?
Well, Emma made a point there, didn't she, that she found the painting disappointing. But I think she'd only find it disappointing when she actually knew that it wasn't what she thought it was before she knew it wasn't what she thought it was, if you know what I mean. When she knew it was a fake, when you know it's a fake, you look at it and think, oh, gosh, of course, I could have seen that, told you straight away it was a fake. Well, you can't. You tell yourself that afterwards. When if Emma was actually looking at two Monets side by side and one was a fake and one was not, I would challenge her to say, OK, you know, put all your bank balance on that one. And, you know, it's very tricky. It's only when you're told, if you know what I mean, when you assume the passive role and then someone says, that's a fake, you go, oh, yes, of course. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's a state of mind. Lainey and I talking about this, actually, and it there is so much of a kind of state of mind involved in this, and she does bring this out in her book as well. It's to do with the state of perception, what you perceive, that Emma's point was very well made, but it is such a grey area that I'm beginning to think, frankly, that you know, good fake art is the next big thing.
Lainey, do you agree? Fake art, the next big thing?
Yeah, I mean, I have the feeling the public has no choice. We can't afford the real thing. I mean, it's crazy that paintings are going for $140 million and being locked in someone's home, and we're being denied the beauty of it. So fakes serve a purpose. They give us access to the inspiration and to the creation and to the spiritual production of art. And we shouldn't be denied that. That's what makes us humans, and that's what makes living life so much fun. Why do only the elite get to enjoy it? So if there's a good faker out there, and even if I know it's a fake, I'd love to see it.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking today about the true story of forgery and fraud in the world of art. Lainey Salisbury is with me this hour. She's the author of the new book, Provenance, How a Con Man and a Forger Rewrote the History of Modern Art. John Myatt is also with us. He's the master forger, profiled in Lainey's new book. And you can see some of those forged paintings through our website, onpointradio.org. Let's go back to the phones to Naples, Florida. Now, Jesse is on the line. Jesse, hello.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Hey, well, the comment I actually had to make was that the art world, I like how Lainey was saying that we all feel like we're not part of this sophisticated world in a way, being so far removed from it. These paintings are so expensive. But that the great thing about these forgeries is that really, if they look so much like the original, wouldn't they be worth as much as the original in a way? That in the art world, it seems
wish.
When it comes to investing in a painting, you know, people want it because it looks as if something as this man had made, you know, back like Monet or Picasso, or if you even look at Fluxus art, which is very abstract and silly. Sometimes, you know, you have a toilet with some paint in it that could sell for millions of dollars, and that if it looks just like the original in a way, according to these people who are investing in it for the only purpose of investing and having this art to almost say, I have this and you do not, mm-hmm. wouldn't it be worth the original almost?
Jesse, thank you. John Mai, respond to the caller.
I got a customer actually in Tennessee, in your country, and he had two original Van Goghs, quite small ones, and he wanted a third, and he didn't want to get it from auction, and he sent me pictures of the frames, and it was behind this Teng glass, it's called, very expensive glass, which you can't actually see. And so I created the third, and evidently he has this happened about 3 years ago. He has a whale of a time with his three paintings, just as it were, tells people that one of them is not quite what it seems, and would they spot it? You know, and that's exactly the lady from Naples, the point she made. I'm right there with her. I think it's why on earth I don't get paid hundreds of thousands of pounds for what I do, I don't know, but I don't. Death is the best career move for someone like me. And unfortunately, you know, I'm trying to put that off for as long as I can.
So, John Mai, tell me the process of painting for you now. How do you do it? You admit it, that you're painting pictures that already exist, right? You stamp your name right on the back?
Yeah, I do. And there's a thing called mens rea in our country, and probably in yours too, state of mind at the point of sale. If you're selling a thing and you're knowingly trying to deceive someone, quite frankly, you're just saying this is a Picasso and it's worth, you know, if your state of mind is a criminal one, then you're committing a criminal offence. So if you sign a thing Picasso on the front and say it's not a Picasso actually, I've just painted it, that's fine, you're okay. If the person you've sold it to then goes on to criminalise the painting, that's not your fault. And that's how I'm making my living until I'm 65. And when I'm 65, I am going to pack it up. I'm desperate to start my own work and just paint people's portraits and generally kind of, you know, if at all possible, Jane, put this episode of my life behind me and you know, move on a bit while I've got a bit of life left in me.
It's been good for business, though, hasn't it, John?
Well, isn't that the strangest thing? I mean, isn't that, you know, I spoke to an American about this, and they were saying it would have been impossible in your country for a policeman like Jonathan to be a friend, send me art materials into prison, and to for us to have ended up to be good chums the way we are now. American people just can't quite understand it. But it did happen, and
in fact, he encouraged you to begin painting again. He even commissioned a family portrait,
yeah.
as Lainey mentioned earlier, from you. The prosecutor in the case commissioned a painting as well.
The prosecutor and the foreman of the jury too actually came and bought a painting. I think they thought he was rehabilitating me. Frankly, I mean, when you come out of prison, I just felt I was just one of the lowest life forms on earth. How on earth could I do this? You know, and I get back home, everybody sort of says, oh, marvellous, John, nice to see you back. And there was no problem when I came out, but I'm thinking to myself, you idiot. And this chap calls me up and says, what are you doing? And I said, oh, I don't know, I'm just going to get a job somewhere. He says, you should be painting, John. You should be painting. You have lots of admirers in Scotland Yard. Get on and paint. Anyway, I did, and he, within 6 months, I had best part of £10,000 in the bank.
Ah, my goodness. Let's go back to the phones. Fort Myers, Florida. Ron is on the line. Hello, Ron. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I love the show.
Thank you.
And I love the Robin Hood story. Fact matter, I'm at the Home Depot now picking up some house paint. And
don't do it.
I wonder where you learned how to paint, John, for one thing. And how much for a self-portrait of you? I can't imagine anything better to have on my wall and show my friends, which is, I think, the purpose of art. I don't want to lock it up. nobody's going to take their U-Haul to heaven. It's better to see it and be moved by it. So Ron, thanks for the show.
Thank you, Ron. Thank you for calling. John Myatt, first, where'd you learn to paint?
I went to art school, the same as, you know, 5-6 years in art school, and sort of learning my trade. And then I went into teaching and then did a bit of lecturing, actually, college lecturing. So I was pretty much sort of brought up in it. And my father and mother encouraged me to do that. Hmm. So, yeah, I just it was a thing I could do, probably one of the only things I could do properly.
Here's George from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. George, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hey, hi, Jane Clayson, how are you?
Hi, well, go ahead, thank you.
Love your show. Let me just say this first. Pablo Picasso said, good artists borrow, great artists steal. And I think that the guy that is doing the forgery should paint a mugshot of him in jail. I don't think anything's worth going to jail for. I don't do forgeries, but I know it can be done. If you learn technique and you have the right brushes, then it can be done, obviously. Especially Impressionists from the 1850s, Monet, Manet, and Degas, and Renoir.
George, thanks so much for the call. Lenny, what about that today? With new technology, did this make it even easier to do forgeries in such a way?
I think it makes it easier to detect forgeries. Eventually, technology is going to catch up with the forgers. They're increasingly getting better at breaking a picture down into its sub-bands and even analyzing the brush strokes itself, and they can analyze a painting that way. Mm. And you don't need a paint sample to do that, so you don't have to worry about chipping, you know, $40 million painting. So eventually they'll get caught up, but, you know, art is constantly changing, so we may not be interested in canvases 20 years down the road. We're going to want, you know, $12 million stuffed sharks or something along those lines. So art will constantly change.
Lainey, I was actually curious, back to John Drew, the person who commissioned these paintings, the con man. Were you surprised that so many people close to him were vulnerable to his cons? I mean, even his own family?
At first I was. And then the more I learned about how con men operate and realizing that most people... A con man is most likely to be within the realm of your friends. It's not likely to be a stranger. I mean, look at Bernie Madoff. He duped his friends, his families, his relatives. But what the biggest mistake I realized that I was doing is I was looking at the con from the outside in. I wasn't looking at the con from the inside out. And once I learned all the deceptive techniques that a con man uses, it really wasn't a surprise to me that they were duped. I mean, they... experts who have studied con men say that what they do is they're great diviners of human behavior. And within a 2-3 minute conversation, they can figure out what your Achilles heel is, what that phantom dream is that you're always trying to achieve. And they're sort of like a blank slate. They represent an image of what you haven't been able to achieve for yourself. And they dangle this in front of you and they lure you in. And they use different ploys to do that. They can figure out whether you're the kind of person that needs command of authority, whether a scarcity ploy will work, a great deal,
reciprocity.
Yes. You know, I've done something for you. Now I'm depending on you to do something for me. Mm-hmm. They'll figure out what your character is like. And they do tend to have a beautiful voice. I mean, John Drew had a wonderful, mellifluous voice. He sounds great on the telephone. Mm. And it's almost like hypnosis. You sort of get lulled into not thinking, almost.
Mm. And from your book and your research, also the pleasure comes from conning those closest to you, your partner, your spouse, your best friend. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. There's no point conning a chump. I mean, there's no thrill in that. They get a kick out of this. It's sort of like a reward system. If you were a drug addict, you know, you get a kick out of having cocaine. I mean, it's somewhat similar with a con man. So there's no fun in conning someone who's not an expert. I mean, granted, John Drew conned all sorts of people. I think he was getting a kick out of being a director of a vast improv theater show. And that's what he was doing. He had fake offices. He had outfits, costumes. He had other people working for him who didn't know he was working for him. He was very busy. you know, it's too bad he didn't put this into something legitimate. He could have been a great, you know, philanthropist or something.
Back to the phones. Here's Judy in Amherst, Massachusetts. Judy, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Thank you very much, Jane. Mm-hmm. This is a question for John. I was wondering if you are clearly such a skilled imitator of other art, what to your mind is lacking for you to become a great artist in your own right?
What a good question, Judy. Thank you. John?
I don't know, is the answer to that. I'm going to have a crack at it when I'm next year for that very reason, that I think it's time to throw away all the props. You are standing on the shoulders of other people when you're recreating something they may or may not have done themselves. So I'm going to have a go at that.
Is it a self-confidence issue?
I'm quite confident. I know what I want to paint. I think many forgers and fakers are in the situation where they have to do what they do because somehow or other the creative thing, the juices have gone. I don't feel that true for myself. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to kick away all the scaffolding. And can I just make one more point going back to what Lainey said?
Certainly.
From the last caller as well, very well made in the book. And she does point up quite clearly that John Drew did something that people hadn't done before, and that is he didn't actually just sell fake paintings, but he filled the archives with fake provenances. Mm. And I picked up this book, and frankly, I read it almost in one sitting, kept me up till about 3 a.m. I didn't know half of what was going on, and Lainey has got this great overview of the way this man perpetrated this crime and the sheer skill that he deployed.
We have a call about that, John, actually. Let's go to Jane in Hopkinton, Massachusetts. Jane, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question about how you make this work, not understanding the art world. I would think they would be in inventory of the original masters, so if someone is trying to sell one, you would go and look it up and find out this couldn't be real because the real one's in the Guggenheim. Hmm.
Jane, thank you. Lainey?
Yeah, that's what many artist estates, they put together what's called a catalog resume, and it's often a multi-volume encyclopedia of all the works that the artists have done, and that is sort of a Bible. But there's always the case where someone is held on to a Giacometti or a Picasso or a Braque that was in the attic that an aunt owned or that a collector had that never got categorized. So that's impossible. That's very possible, particularly if the artist wasn't organized. So John Drew was sort of, what he did was he had John Myatt fake some painters whose catalog resumes weren't completed yet. So that made it somewhat easier. What he also did is he knew where some of the papers of these artists were located, the archives. Every artist has a dealer. Every artist that makes it has a dealer, and then those dealers' papers go into the archives. So if anyone had any doubt, he would put this false provenance into the archives so that when an expert went to look at the paperwork, they would see it and be like, oh, well, this must be true. It didn't make the resume, or it's just a painting that hasn't been found out about yet.
Incredible. Back to the phones, Norfolk, Massachusetts. Sharon is on the line. Hi, Sharon.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
I'm a painter myself, and I have a question for John. When I paint, it's full of accidents. It's a learning experience. I don't know where a painting is going to go. I know that Picasso was extremely skilled and could manipulate anything. But there is still that sense of the unknown, of the discovery. When you copy their paintings, is it dead for you? I mean, how? Because you're really just copying their experience, but are you gaining experience on your own?
Well, you bet. I mean, absolutely. I do teach a course at Cambridge University, actually, summer school, and we do, the students have done a study of Vincent van Gogh's self-portraits, but we do a two-day situation where they sit in front of a mirror and they paint their own portrait in the style of Van Gogh. Now, you learn more in trying to think your way inside that man's head and paint like he did. You learn more. You learn stuff that you can't learn with words if you try and do that kind of thing yourself. And now you mentioned mistakes. I think was it Van Meegeren who said that? If you look at Van Meegeren's fakes now, and they're 30 or 40 years, 50 years old, there's something about them which isn't quite right. They don't look like Vermeer's. Maybe in 50 or 60 years' time, the same will happen to my fakes or a fake that was made, you know, in the 80s and 90s of the last century. The way around that, if you like, and the way to actually get a real kick out of what you're doing is to, particularly with Giacometti, if you don't mind me saying so, is to actually get inside, find out where he was, get inside his head, and just paint. And if accidents happen, well, accidents happen. It doesn't matter.
Mm. Lainey Salisbury, I have about a minute left here. What did the art world learn from this in your documentation of this most far-reaching and elaborate deception? What was the takeaway for the art world itself?
I think mostly just to go back and look at the painting. Stop looking at who did it and where they did it and who owned it, which celebrity owned it, and focus on the work, because usually once a dealer looks at a work, he or she knows right away whether it's authentic. But then once they start seeing everything else, it clouds their judgment. So go back to the original merit of art, which is its beauty.
John Myatt, you're the last word. Do you agree with that?
No, I think Lainey is an absolute star, and she's written an absolutely wonderful book. Frankly, I'm thrilled, and I whatever she says, I agree with it. She's brilliant.
Thank you.
Well, many thanks to both of you. Lainey Salisbury is the author of the new book, Provenance: How a Con Man and a Forger Rewrote the History of Modern Art. I really appreciate your time, Lainey. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks, John.
Thank you, John Myatt,
former art forger, now a painter of legitimate fakes from England today, Stoke, England. John, thank you for your time. Good luck, sir.
Thank you, Jane.
You can see the images of John's forged paintings and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Great to be with you this week. Tom Ashbrook is back on Monday. I'm Jane Clayson. Have a terrific weekend. This is On Point.